Part 3. Aspects of Social Threefolding and Associative Economics. Chapter 7. Transsector Economic Associations, Earthly and Spiritual Potentials. In democratic societies, the science of association is the mother of science. The progress of all the rest depends on the progress it has made. Footnote 77. Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America. The great art form of America is government, and especially the Constitution, and in this art form, it seems to me, America is pointing to the most essential art form of the future, the art of working together as individuals, groups, and communities. This is the essential art form of coming humanity, the art of human association. Footnote 78. Jacob Needleman, The American Soul. Both individualism and associations of people voluntarily working together on a common cause or task have deep roots in American culture. The Frenchman, Alexis de Tocqueville, wrote about this phenomenon in Democracy in America, published in two parts in 1835 and 1840. He recognized that strong individualism, so important for a democratic society, needs to be balanced by more social characteristics. This can be accomplished through working together in associations, which he called the mother of science. Feelings and opinions are recruited, the heart is enlarged, and the human mind is developed only by reciprocal influence by men upon each other. I have shown that these influences are almost null in democratic countries. They must, therefore, be artificially created, and this can only be accomplished by associations. Footnote 79. Tocqueville identified voluntary associations in all sectors of 19th century American life. For example, businesses and economic life, parties, interest groups, and opposition groups in political life, and religious, moral, entertainment, and educational associations in cultural life. Like Tocqueville, Jacob Needleman, who has a modern perspective, asserts the prime importance of associations for the future of America, even though he calls it an art rather than a science. One of Steiner's most significant contributions to economics has been to extend and deepen the concept of the applicability of the principle of association. He did this on two levels, earthly and spiritual. In regard to the earthly, he showed the importance of extending the scope of voluntary associations in the economy from single businesses, professional trade organizations, or consumer associations to embrace all three aspects of economic life: production, distribution, and consumption. Earlier types of economic associations tended to rely on self-interest or self-promotion, generating profits, promoting a trade or industry, or buying more cheaply. The chief purpose and distinguishing feature of transsector economic associations is that they aim to develop cooperation among all three economic sectors and arrive at fully informed and mutually determined decisions that can be implemented in an efficient manner. These associations, consisting of actual participants or their representatives, would collectively and mutually determine such things as prices and amounts, types, and quality of goods and services. Thus, economic decision-making would be conducted by people with direct knowledge and experience of the matters at hand. Unlike the price-fixing that sometimes occurs in the modern market, whereby various producers collude secretively to keep prices artificially high in order to gain greater profits at the expense of consumers, the determination of prices within trans-sector associations involves participants in a transparent, open process of fully informed agreements. Some may object that although worthy, this is a highly impractical goal. However, in terms of the technical aspect, working associatively or collaboratively is no more complex than conducting operations in the modern market. The production, communication, and distribution challenges are similar to a large degree. The key difference is not technical, but social. The motivation of participants in associations is concern for others rather than self-interest. And information is shared with openness and inclusiveness rather than secrecy and divisiveness. Trans-sector economic associations already exist, if only in elementary stages, on both the local and international levels. Community-supported agriculture, CSA, projects, which number in the thousands in the United States, are an example of associated, multi- or trans-sector collaboration on a local level. Footnote 80. They are based, or mutually agreed upon, commitments between farmers and a local community of consumers. The types and quantities of products and finances are determined on an annual basis through ongoing dialogue between both parties. Live Power Community Farm in Covelo, California, for example, describes its CSA approach as an association of involved consumers and dedicated farmers. The farmers provide a weekly basket of fresh, high-quality vegetables in season, while the shareholders commit their financial and volunteer support for a minimum of one growing season. Footnote 81. CSA farms have increased in number and size, and the CSA movement has developed many associative practices and innovations that extend beyond a single farm. For instance, rather than a single farm attempting to produce all the products for its community, production has been shared among one or more farms through formal or informal contractual agreements. Also, we have seen the development of a distinct distribution function as shared production has emerged and when farms establish off-farm distribution sites for consumer groups or home delivery route. While it is clear that the CSA movement is successful in creating ongoing dialogue between farmers and consumers, some people doubt that such a collaborative and highly personal way of working is possible on a regional, let alone an international scale. Admittedly, size is an important factor to take into consideration when developing economic associations. However, economic associations can also be effective on a larger scale through representatives working on behalf of each sector and through the networking of various associations. In any case, the viability and dynamics of an economic association is definitely influenced by its size. If it is too small, it will not be economically viable. And if it is too large, the exchanging of perspectives and communication between the various sectors may be hampered and become overly time-consuming. But these are natural and healthy parameters. The actual workings of the association will determine the manageable limits for a given industrial or service sector. In contrast, the conditions we now face in the current economic arrangements are the result of the fact that there is no inherent market mechanism to determine appropriate size limits on the upper end. Rather, the whole economic system has become dependent on businesses that are supposedly too big to fail, and as a consequence, require massive government bailouts if they appear to be faltering financially. The CSA movement has focused mainly on local food production, which in the northern part of the United States may be only a small percentage of a family's total food consumption in a given year. An important question is, could the CSA associative model be the basis for a much more extensive domestic or even international economic food supply chain that can supply a significantly greater portion of a family's food needs? Footnote 82. The answer is yes. It will become increasingly possible to develop associative relations on a much broader basis as the CSA movement grows in any given region of the United States. Let's say that within a 75-mile radius, there are 10 CSA farms with an average of 100 participating families. Footnote 83. Let's also assume a conservative figure of 2 persons per family. That yields a consumer base of 2,000 people. These CSA families could associate together and assess their collective non-CSA food needs. Based on these statistics, they could form a regional consumer association and contract with local food processors and farms further south, where the growing season is longer, in order to meet a larger portion of their food requirement. Such a consumer group could also associate with specific farmers or cooperatives in Central and South America to produce coffee and tropical fruit rather than relying on the impersonal market. These same consumer families would be in a position to set up and invest in their own low-interest capitalization fund that supports the farms and distributors within their associative network. In this scenario, we can see how an extension of the CSA movement could help transform the food economy from competing businesses to collaborating associations of farmers, distributors, and consumers. Footnote 84. There are, in fact, numerous examples of businesses, distributors, and consumer groups working associatively on an international level, if only in an elementary way. The fair trade movement is developing distribution systems with fair prices while assisting farmers and craftspeople in developing countries to market their products to consumers in more industrialized nations. Equal Exchange, a worker cooperative in Massachusetts and pioneer of fair trade coffee in the United States, is one example of this. Footnote 85. Equal Exchange acts as a distributor and processor for smaller farmer cooperatives that use sustainable farming methods in developing countries. They currently offer coffee, tea, chocolate, and snacks with annual sales of over $20 million. Part of Equal Exchange's social mission is to establish prices that are fair to farmers and foster closer connections between consumers and the farmers they rely on. In keeping with this mission, as a distributor, Equal Exchange enters into dialogue with the farm cooperatives to learn about their needs, to determine a fair price for their products, and to assist them in achieving quality production standards suitable for international markets. Equal Exchange is also active in educating consumers in the United States about the farmers who produce the products they consume by arranging for farmers from other countries to meet with consumer groups in the U.S. and by creating informative point-of-purchase materials. Another example of businesses working associatively on an international scale is the organic cotton supply chain set up by the Swiss-based trading company Remme AG. Footnote 86. Under the leadership of Patrick Homan, Remme AG has developed a supply chain of associated businesses based on cooperation and transparency, beginning with several thousand small organic cotton farmers in India and Tanzania. Remme AG markets organic cotton thread, yarn, and clothing worldwide, including clothing for the Naturaline Ecolabel of Coop Swiss, a Swiss consumer cooperative network with over 2 million member consumers. Steiner's description of the expansion of the principle of economic associations to include all three sectors of production, distribution, and consumption has its counterpart on the spiritual level. In this regard, he points to the significance of working together in associations for the spiritual advancement of humanity as a whole. Alexis de Tocqueville also referred to the benefits of participating in associations for the individual, the expansion of heart and mind, and for the group, mutual understanding by all participants. Steiner goes further by taking into consideration the attitude or disposition of soul that a person carries into the dialogues and activities of associations. The spoken word in conversation is the artistic and scientific medium for modern associations. From a spiritual perspective, every human association, whether it be congregation, school, political party, business, or informal gathering, is an opportunity to collaborate with higher powers. The collective feelings of the participants in a group stream together to create a vessel for divine beings to connect with the activity. The intentionality, level of attentiveness, and the quality of feelings and thoughts that a group of people bring to a gathering will determine what kind and degree of spiritual support they will attract while working together. The phases national, community, and team spirit take on real meaning when considered from this perspective. Even more so does the statement by Christ, "When two or more are gathered in my name, there I am in their midst." Footnote 87. Steiner describes the spiritual dynamics of associations in the following way. When human beings find themselves together in voluntary associations, they group themselves around centers. The feelings streaming in this way to a center give beings the opportunity of working as a kind of group soul. Indeed, in a certain respect, we may say that they support their existence on human harmony. It will lie in individual souls whether or not they give as many as possible of such higher souls the opportunity of descending to humanity. The more people are divided, the fewer lofty souls will descend into the human sphere. The more associations are formed, where feelings of fellowship are developed in complete freedom, the more lofty beings will descend, and the more rapidly the earthly planet will be spiritualized. Footnote 88. While voluntary associations can be formed in any realm of life, it is economic life that provides untold opportunities for creating local associations that can be networked globally. Economic life can thus provide a unique opportunity for the planet to be spiritualized by caring people worldwide freely associating together to meet the needs of human beings. From everything said above regarding Steiner's ideas on transsection economic associations, we can conclude that they, 1, reestablish the principles of unity and inclusiveness in economic life. The introduction of the division of labor has enabled a tremendous increase in human productivity and has created the conditions for machinery and technology to arise. However, the division of labor and the factory system have brought divisiveness at many levels. The worker has become alienated from his work. Management has become a distinct activity separate from labor, and owners and workers have become separate classes of people with differing perspectives on life and work. Economic associations bring about a unifying effect in economic life, whereby producers, distributors, and consumers collaborate together and share perspectives in mutual respect. Through their associative workings, they achieve understanding for the whole economic process. Furthermore, workers and management are viewed as co-producers or partners in production of goods and services. 2. Infuse work with meaning and purpose. Prior to the division of labor, a worker had a direct relation to his products, and often to the people for whom they were intended. Specialization and the factory environment have made it difficult to derive meaning and satisfaction from work itself or the partial product provided. Through economic associations, workers can perceive the value and importance of their work for the community of people they are serving. Thus, work becomes meaningful through social awareness. 3. Introduce human intention in economic life. Proponents of the market economy view it as a self-regulating system that operates best with no human or state intervention through such measures as tariffs, subsidies, and price regulation. Economic associations allow the producers, distributors, and consumers who are involved in the economic process to match production with expressed needs of consumers. This can involve adjusting the supply of goods and services, establishing quality standards, and determining the best distribution system. Thus, the market is not left to its own devices, as in a so-called free market, nor is it directed by people who are not involved with the economic process under consideration, as in socialism, but through fully informed participants. 4. Instill social awareness and responsibility in economic decisions and activities. When various participants of economic associations come together to work through economic decisions, a social awareness arises that is not possible in the market economy. Participants not only have the opportunity to express their perspectives, wishes, and needs, but also are confronted with the views and needs of others in the context of the whole economic process. This awareness is supported by ethical capacities developed in the independent cultural life. 5. Promote openness and transparency. Trans-sector economic associations, as described here, are designed to make economic decision-making and activities open and transparent, not only to the actual participants, but to the broader public as well. Chapter 8. Freedom, Funding, and Accountability in Education. One of the least appreciated tenets of a threefold social organism is the necessity for the emancipation of education from government control. Nonetheless, we must understand today why separating school and state is just as important a cultural goal for a free and democratic society as the separation of church and state was previously. Even most advocates of systemic social change never question the idea that government education, commonly known as public education in the United States, is the pillar of democratic society. In discussions on educational freedom, the assumption is made that such freedom can somehow be created within the vast structure and oversight of the state. Corporate interests are actively and openly sought by government education reformers to help shape government education reform. For the last three decades, education reform, which includes the implementation of national goals, standards, and assessments, has been the collaborative effort of the federal government and big business. The Goals 2000 Educate America Act and the No Child Left Behind Act, created by Democratic and Republican administrations respectively, are nothing more than financial and corporate interests and thinking codified into law. Footnote 89. Consequently, virtually all education reform has been subjugated to the apparent necessity of accelerated economic growth at the expense of all other cultural and democratic needs. Numerous interest groups, most significantly teachers' unions, actively oppose any attempt to develop an education funding system that might result in reducing the role of the traditional local public school in educating children. Their opposition is understandable. Recent studies have shown that the educational landscape in the United States would change dramatically if all parents could choose the school they think is best for their children, instead of most of them being compelled by financial constraints to send their children to the local public school. Currently, from 85 to 88% of children are educated in government schools. According to recent surveys conducted as part of independent research in six states sponsored by the Foundation for Educational Choice, footnote 90, see illustration 3, parents, if enabled to do so, would choose the following school options for their children. Private school, 39%. Charter school, 11%. Homeschool, 10%. Local public school, 38%. Virtual school, 1%. Don't know, less than 1%. Taking these results as an indication of what parents really want for their children, private schools and homeschools would account for approximately 49% of elementary and secondary education school children, instead of the current 13.5%. And government schooling, local public schools and charter schools, would account for approximately 49% instead of the current 86.5%. This clearly presents a path to improving education, increasing parental involvement in education, student graduation rates, and teacher innovation. That path begins and ends with parental choice in education. From a social threefolding perspective, we can acknowledge that government education as the means of educating children had a useful purpose for a period of time. However, the time has passed for it to be the main means of educating children, as the parents' responses to the surveys confirm. to persist in compelling the majority of school-aged children to attend specific schools contrary to the better judgment of their parents has become one of the greatest injustices suffered by the American public. It is also one of the greatest threats to political democracy and cultural freedom in modern times. It is essential that activists in the field of alternative economics begin to understand the importance of educational freedom and the necessity for developing new forms of funding education that allow all parents to choose the education they think the most appropriate for their children. Not to do so is to say to all parents, "The state knows what is better for your children than you do." The following aphoristic statements provide a basis for freedom, funding, and accountability in education from the perspective of a threefold social organism, a basis that would provide independent schools an equal opportunity to offer their services to the public. Footnote 91. Inclusive public education should be more than just government schools. A well-educated public is essential for a democratic society. Educating the public or public education should not be restricted to a specific type of school or schooling system. Government schools, independent schools, religious schools, and homeschooling all need to be viewed as valid approaches to educating the public. An intermediate step towards separation of school and state is to reduce the role of government schooling from a public requirement for most families to a public option available to all families, an option that is eventually funded in the same manner as all other schools. Every child in a democratic society has a right to a decent education. The right to a decent education needs to be recognized and upheld as an equal opportunity for all children. Compelling families to send their children to schools that are unsafe or clearly unable to meet their educational needs is a denial and abrogation of such a right. Regarding education, a society's primary legal obligation is to its children and their rights, not to a particular school or a schooling system. Society's obligation to uphold the right of all children to a decent education means first and foremost that all parents of school-aged children should have the final resources to provide them with a decent education. Otherwise, that right is meaningless. For most families, this right has devolved to compulsory attendance at a local public school whose educational goals, standards, and assessments are determined by the state. There needs to be one financially level playing field for all types of schooling. All families should have financial resources sufficient to ensure their freedom to choose from a variety of local schooling options for their children, whether government, independent, religious, or home schools. The financial viability of a school should depend ultimately on its ability to win the confidence and appreciation of parents and students, rather than on the government's determination of which schools or types of schools should receive funding and the use of power to compel families to send their children to them. In other words, parents, as their children's representatives, should have the ultimate say concerning which schools should exist, not legislative bodies or political interest groups. The independent school movement would welcome the opportunity to educate children from all economic backgrounds. Independent schools have been fairly limited in their ability to educate children from low and middle-income families because of outdated state funding mechanisms. In general, Waldorf and other types of independent schools would welcome the opportunity to have greater diversity in their schools and serve a much broader public. An equitable and efficient funding system for education is an essential component of a free and democratic society. An equitable funding system would not place a disproportionate burden on those who have the least ability to pay. The ideal funding system is one that collects and distributes funds efficiently in a transparent manner and does not burden schools with undue regulations. Funding programs based on education tax credits are examples of an efficient and cost-effective means to enable families of all economic backgrounds to select the type of education for their children that they think is most appropriate. Various states have enacted tax credit legislation, including Arizona, Florida, Georgia, Indiana, Iowa, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island. Footnote 92. The Public Education Tax Credit Model legislation, developed at the Cato Institute, allows individuals and businesses to contribute directly to schools or scholarship programs on behalf of a child's tuition and receive a tax credit applicable to a variety of taxes. The fact that these types of tax credit programs do not involve government funds, but rather encourage private sector funding instead of public, tax, money, to uphold a child's right to an education, removes a major justification for the attachment of onerous government regulations to education tax credit legislation. Footnote 93. Teachers should have the freedom to teach out of personal knowledge and classroom experience. The world is changing. Social conditions are changing. Human consciousness is evolving. Consequently, education needs to be an evolving art and science. Each child is unique, and each new generation has new capacities, interests, and challenges. Teachers need the opportunity and freedom to be innovative and respond based on their direct insight to the needs of each child and to the changing conditions of the world. In turn, each upcoming generation needs the opportunity to develop the insight and capacities to improve and, if necessary, transform the existing economic and political systems, not simply fit into them. Independent schools should have the freedom to set their own educational goals, standards, and assessments. Independence and freedom in education is meaningless if all schools are compelled to adhere to the same values, goals, standards, and assessments dictated by a centralized authority. Independent schools and homeschoolers in particular should have the freedom to establish their own goals, standards, and assessments and create their own accrediting associations. Otherwise, their status as independent has no significance. Eventually, all schools should have this freedom. Independent schools should be accountable to the families they serve, the accrediting bodies they choose, and the state where they are located. Independent schools that fully inform their school families about their educational goals, curriculum standards, and assessment methods would be judged by their performance. In a free and just society, they would have the freedom to create and be held accountable to independent school accrediting organizations that they choose. It is appropriate that independent schools abide by appropriate state laws and regulations regarding safety, upholding of contractual commitments, the unacceptability of hate-based fractions and fraud, and fair employment practices. Real competition in education is the key to providing the best education possible for all students. In summation, real competition in education is the most efficient way to give parents of all financial and cultural backgrounds the opportunity to become actively involved in their children's education. This will enable the most valued educational approaches and schools to succeed, and ultimately will allow all children to have the best education possible. Chapter 9. The Economic Necessity for Educational and Cultural Freedom. A Human Perspective. Along with fostering the all-important qualities of precision, efficiency, and timelessness, the modern market economy is also dependent on certain lower human attributes prevailing in business and commerce. These attributes include self-interested behavior, competitive instincts, a craving for personal power, and an insatiable desire for material goods and comfort. In contrast, an associative economy, as part of a threefold social organism, as described here, would rely on and even foster a greater array of high-order capacities and virtues than what the modern market requires. These traits include an interest in and care for other people and society as a whole, a love of work, and an appreciation and respect for nature. An essential step in ensuring the development of high-order attributes is to liberate cultural life, including education, from political and corporate influence. As an apparent educational tool, state-mandated, norm-referenced high-stakes tests tend to limit education, and hence general human development and culture, to a narrow set of human qualities, primarily focused on what is needed to sustain the existing market economy. Footnote 94. We should not educate our children with the goal of fitting them as economic beings into the competitive economy, as if this were the most important aspect of life. Human beings are spiritual as well. Nor should we make the presumption that government and big business know more about educating children than educators in the classroom, or accept that they know what type of schooling is better for a given child than the child's parents. Enabling the human spirit to come to full development out of its own nature and resources, a necessity of our time, requires that education establish its own independent administrative bodies and develop its own goals, standards, and assessments, rather than having them dictated by state agencies that are in turn heavily influenced by big business. An economic perspective. Economic life itself needs to be viewed as a living organism that is subject to the same laws as all living organisms. One such law is the need for continual rejuvenation in order to maintain life. Historically, the market has relied on accelerated growth and mergers to revitalize what was assumed to be an open-ended economy. As the business maxim, grow, merge, or die, implies, footnote 95. In a desperate attempt to assure continued growth and forestall economic decline, businesses engage in the following types of activities. Enter into ever larger mergers. Lobby to remove environmental protection laws to reduce immediate manufacturing costs and maintain cheap access to natural resources. Continually move factories to countries where labor is less expensive. Expand markets by turning everything possible into a commodity, including public water supplies and plant species. Increase future market efficiency by inculcating self-interest and the desire for profit in children through educational goals and standards collaboratively developed by big business and government. Downsize the number of workers and force those who are left behind to increase their workloads. We are now in a one-world global economy, and a new source of rejuvenation must be found for economic life. From a social threefolding perspective, human beings educated in an independent spiritual cultural life that encourages development of their full personal and social capacities are themselves the ultimate source of these rejuvenating forces. One capacity that is essential for continual renewal of the economy is creativity. Ken Robinson, a world-renowned expert in human creativity, makes the case that government-sponsored education reform programs, including the U.S. No Child Left Behind program, which was largely designed by big business, actually kill creativity and minimize the importance of such creative-building activities as the arts in education. Footnote 96. Steiner maintains that each rising generation brings with it essential regenerative forces that the economy needs. Otherwise, it will self-destruct. The economy thinking of the present is a destructive element, which must, therefore, be continually counterbalanced by the constructive element of the spiritual limb, cultural realm, of the social organism. In every generation, through the children we teach at school, something is given to us. Something is sent down from the spiritual world. We take hold of this in education. This is something spiritual, and incorporate it in economic life and ward off its destruction. For economic life, if it runs its own course, destroys itself. Footnote 97. an economic system that dictates a society's education policy and culture through the coercive powers of the state is on a suicidal track. It will cultivate only those capacities and skills needed to perpetuate the existing economic and political order. And in doing so, economic life will strangle the source of its own creative life forces, the inexhaustible font of human capacities and creativity arising from cultural life. Chapter 10. Individual and Cultural Freedom. The educational development of an independent, self-directed human being who can bring rejuvenating forces to economic life through entrepreneurial initiative and creativity, social sensitivity and skills, and ethical certitude is contingent on four educational and social factors. All four must be taken into consideration in any effort to develop an authentic and independent cultural life and educational system consistent with a threefold social organism. Liberty. By liberty, we commonly mean political independence or freedom from outer restrictions and control by the state. However, the ultimate source of political oppression can be cultural when, for instance, fundamentalist religious groups impose their dogma on society through the laws of the state. Or, oppression can be rooted in economic life through the lobbying of corporate interest groups. Indeed, the greatest modern-day threat to liberty is in fact rooted in the economic sector, notwithstanding the fact that a healthy economic life itself requires entrepreneurial freedom and initiative. For example, modern political life and government education are a reflection of economic interests and economic thinking to a degree that is detrimental to democracy and culture. It is commonly recognized that politicians, regardless of party affiliation, are little more than marionettes whose strings are manipulated by corporate interests and financiers. This is made possible through the fact that wealth and its attendant power are concentrated in a relatively small number of people and groups. Because of the unholy alliance that exists between financial interest groups and government, such economic wealth has come to represent not only economic power, but cultural and political power as well. These pockets of concentrated economic power in the social organism are similar to a human organism besieged with tumors. Initiatives working in harmony with the principles of a threefold social organism are hygienic measures that combat such unhealthy concentrations of wealth and ensure the maintenance of cultural freedom. Full development of capacities. We have recognized that the primary function of cultural life is to enable the development of human capacities to the fullest possible extent. Individuals cannot become self-directed human beings and exercise freedom of will as long as their innate capacities remain dormant. Although the intent of national and state-mandated norm-referenced high-stakes tests is to improve student performance and to measure progress toward educational goals, such testing serves little or no educational purpose other than grading and ranking students according to a very narrow set of learning goals. Footnote 98. To the degree that this is true, such tests actually have a crippling effect on future economic productivity, insofar as potential capacities that are not measurable by such tests are left undeveloped. As a noteworthy exception to this crippling trend, Waldorf schools, which decline to administer standardized tests, place significant emphasis on developing creative imagination and social skills, both of which are essential capacities in an associative-based economy. Overcoming inner obstacles. Even when individuals are blessed with liberty, their exercise of free will can be undermined owing to personal soul weaknesses or obstacles such as uncontrolled passions, fearfulness, inability to concentrate, insensitivity, or lack of self-worth, These may be inherited or externally inflicted traits. One of the main goals of any true education toward freedom is to help students overcome these types of soul weaknesses. If such weaknesses or tendencies are not or cannot be addressed pedagogically, then they may develop into more severe problems that will need to be addressed medically later on. Economic dependency. The full development of an individual's potential can also be compromised by insufficient financial resources. This can occur in two ways. The first is the obstruction of access to educational opportunities through inadequate financial resources. Under the current system in the United States, parents with insufficient income are often forced to send their child to schools they do not think are adequately educating their children. The second obstruction is the hindering of the application of developed capacities. This occurs, for example, when capable entrepreneurs who want to produce something of value for society cannot obtain the necessary capital or means of production to do so. For instance, it is often impossible for young farmers to obtain loans to expand their enterprises because they do not have sufficient collateral according to conventional banking standards. In both these cases, the impending of individual aspirations or contributions results in thwarting the rejuvenation of economic life. The education of all children to their full potential and access to capital for individuals who want to meet a recognized community or societal need are key features of the threefold social organism and priorities in an associative economy. Chapter 11. Rights and Single-Payer Systems for Education and Healthcare. Steiner's ideas on the funding of education are another departure from the thinking prevalent today among sociologists, economics, politicians, and indeed the general public. The commonly held view is that education is the responsibility of the state, and therefore the state should determine what is most worth learning and doing in life, and that government should fund education through tax revenues. Steiner maintains, however, that education should be funded directly by economic life, see Illustration 4, rather than by means of a single-payer, that is, the government, system financed by tax revenues, see Illustration 5. Traditionally, in the United States, these funds have been given primarily to local public schools, which have been the only option for the vast majority of families who could not afford other options, such as independent schools, parochial schools, or homeschooling. Steiner's indications for education funding follow from his recognition and affirmation of the right of every child to an education, meaning that every child should have an equal opportunity to a decent education, rather than being compelled to attend a particular government school. He also takes the view, which is not an unusual one, that tax revenue, which is public funding, requires public oversight even in a democratic society. Consequently, it is appropriate for the state to regulate education if it provides for the funding. All state-funded projects are of necessity subject to majority rule and attendant bureaucratic regulations. The idea that an independent education system could realistically exist within a state schooling system is contrary to the very nature of both government and independent education. An education system will be independent only if it has an independent administration and operates outside of any political influence. However, the state does have three financial obligations important for upholding the right of every child to an education. The state needs to determine 1. The amount of education subsidy that is required from the economy for the education of children on an annual basis. 2. How much each of the various types of businesses and individuals should be obliged to contribute to education. 3. Who is eligible to receive such funds? For example, children of a certain age and families within certain income parameters. In order to arrive at informed decisions on these matters, the state will need to enter into deliberations with representatives of the education and economic sectors. Footnote 99. The education tax credit movement in the United States is one of the more promising steps toward creating an educational funding system that does not rely solely on government funds while still enabling the state to fulfill the three functions just noted. Currently, 11 states have personal tax credits or donation tax credit programs in which individuals or corporations can make contributions directly to scholarship programs or to schools on behalf of the children's education expenses. Footnote 100. As already mentioned, one of the most innovative recent model education tax credit programs is the Public Education Tax Credit Act, proposal developed by Adam B. Schaefer at the Cato Institute. Footnote 101. It provides for a child's educational expenses through contributions that are eligible for credits on a variety of taxes, including personal and business income, sales, and property taxes. Footnote 102. Much of what has been said about the funding of education can also be applied to funding of health care. Access to basic health coverage should also be viewed as a human right for all people. As in the case of the right to an education, the government has three basic duties in upholding the right to health care: determining the amount of funds the economy needs to generate for basic health care coverage, determining how much individuals and organizations are obligated to contribute to the financing of health care coverage, and who is eligible and how much each person might be eligible to receive for health care coverage. One way possible to implement this approach is for the economy to contribute a certain amount of money directly into non-governmental health care funds that eligible people could access to pay for health care coverage. As with education, the government's role should be limited to the three functions mentioned, and it need not be the collector or administrator of the funds. Sufficient, non-burdensome regulations for both education and health care could guarantee transparency and protection against fraudulent use of funds. Currently, the right to universal health care coverage is usually equated with a compulsory, government-administered and funded single-payer system. This is considered to be the only viable alternative to a voluntary free market approach in which vast numbers of people have no money to pay for health care. What is presented here suggests a third way to uphold the right to health care coverage while allowing for maximum individual freedom of choice, both in selecting the type of coverage and medical modality. It must be acknowledged that as long as big business and unions play such a powerful role in our legislative processes as they currently do now at the state and federal levels, they will use any attempt to change the funding of education or health care as an opportunity to expand their power and influence and create new markets. Chapter 12. Economic Indices and Basic Human Needs. Our technological age has enabled empirical researchers to generate an enormous range and amount of economic statistics. Some broad categories of economic indicators are productivity, income, prices, employment, wages, credit, and balance of trade. Each category, in turn, provides an array of statistics. These can be used to validate virtually any political or economic agenda, as demonstrated by the statements of politicians when campaigning for election. If we decide to work toward a more associative economy, we need to focus, at least initially, on certain specific economic indicators. If we take as a premise that the primary purpose of economic life is to meet the material needs of human beings, then we can first focus on those key economic indicators that show how well the economy is succeeding in this regard. We should investigate, in other words, to what degree the economy in a given nation or region is meeting the basic needs of everyone within that area by providing affordable products and services. The following basic human needs of every person should be affordable: clean food and potable water, housing, clean air and sunshine, clothing for personal and work life, health care, education, transportation options, access to basic communications technology. The determination of what constitutes the norms for basic human needs in a given area is not the task of the economic sector. Rather, it is the primary responsibility of the state or rights sphere to determine what the basic needs are for individuals. Obviously, in a healthy society, representatives of the rights sector will need to take into consideration the productivity of the economy when determining what realistically can be provided overall in each category of need. Clearly, the economy is not expected to produce clean air and sunshine, but continuous access to them must be ensured by the state through environmental laws and regulations. There are two other important economic indicators to monitor. One is the amount of available capital for entrepreneurs who want to provide a product or service to meet an essential need. The current system of finance is structured to capitalize almost exclusively the most economically profitable business initiatives. This system falls short at capitalizing endeavors that meet vital community needs but may yield little profit for investors. For example, a relatively inexpensive natural remedy with ingredients that are readily accessible and easily processed without costly equipment may not find a source for necessary startup capital, while a more expensive and perhaps less effective remedy that has the potential to yield large profits will attract large amounts of venture capital. This first product may provide a greater benefit for the community through a general improvement of health at a lower cost than the second product that provides less public health benefit, but a larger financial return for a few investors. Thus, it would be a significant economic and social benefit to identify, monitor, and publicize innovative methods of commercial funding that place at least an equal emphasis on social benefit as on amount of return. The slow money or patient capital movement led by social entrepreneur Woody Tash, which focuses on financing agriculture-related ventures, is an example of how to encourage investors to think beyond maximizing economic returns. Some examples of organizations involved in providing capital for community-minded businesses that produce important goods or services, which may not necessarily be highly profitable, are RSF Social Finance, TBL Capital, and Shore Bank, footnote 104. Another important economic indicator to monitor is philanthropic giving for cultural endeavors in a given region. This should include not only the amount of money being given to various types of organizations, but also who is giving and how much. The problem of significant concentration of wealth in economic life has a social parallel in philanthropy, where certain individuals or foundations control vast amounts of philanthropic assets. Large foundations have an undue influence in determining which cultural initiatives succeed and which do not. Thus, they can have a disproportionately strong influence on cultural life itself. Bill Gates, whose foundation has assets of approximately $30 billion, has a huge impact on the role of computer technology in education reform, beyond what any single person or organization should have. No single source of money, individual, corporate, or state, should have such an enormous degree of influence and power over education or any other aspect of cultural life. In summary, economic indicators in these three areas, individual basic needs, availability of capital, and philanthropy, provide the minimum essential information that would be needed to monitor any effort to transform and continually renew economic life consistent with the principles of associative economics. Chapter 13, Money and Morality, From Citizens to Supra-Rulers. The love of money is the root of all evil. First letter from St. Paul to Timothy, 6:10. Government and banking have colluded to create a money system that embodies a debt imperative that results in a growth imperative, which forces environmental destruction and rends the social fabric while increasing the concentration of power and wealth. It creates economic and political instabilities that manifest in recurrent cycles of depression and inflation, domestic and international conflict, and social dislocation. Footnote 105. Thomas H. Greco, Jr., The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. It is important to note that people often misquote the first statement above, saying that money is the root of all evil. Rather, it is the love of money that is the culprit. St. Paul is referring to our relation to money, our love of the power that it represents, and what we imagine we can do with that power. Implicit in this thought is that the lover of money is thinking in selfish terms, with little regard for other people or the planet we live on. If it is true that self-centered acquisition and use of money can cause harm and suffering in the world, then it must also be true that it is possible to use money out of higher motives to engage in acts of moral goodness. Again, this suggests that money itself is not the culprit, but rather the person who uses it. Indeed, history is replete with abundant examples of individuals doing both good and ill with their money. In our times, we have experienced people such as Bernie Madoff, the Wall Street investor and former chairman of the NASDAQ Stock Exchange, who defrauded individuals and organizations of an estimated $12 to $20 billion. His greed and lavish lifestyle had no limits. At the time of his arrest in 2008, Madoff's personal assets were valued at close to $1 billion, which included $17 million in cash, a $7 million yacht, four residences worth a total of $22 million, and $12 million worth of jewelry, art, and furniture. For his crimes, Madoff was sentenced to an equally impressive 150 years imprisonment. Footnote 106. While this may seem to be an individual case of unusually extreme deception and exploitation, we are now faced with a national, if not worldwide, financial crisis that is rooted in the systemic financial abuse of subprime mortgages, credit cards, and the unregulated derivatives market. Footnote 107. Even so, at the same time that we have this widespread cavalierism and immense greed, we can also identify examples of people and institutions working creatively with money for the good of society, including those mentioned in previous chapters. Footnote 108. However, there is a growing body of research and commentary that suggests that the mechanism of money creation and finance determines to a large degree what individual ethical and social impulses can or cannot flow into social life. We have quoted Alan Greenspan, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank, as saying that business people have many more ways to express greed in economic life than ever before. Our modern economy is known for concentrating wealth in the hands of a relatively small group of people, who are often operators in the financial markets, including banking. To maintain continued domination of our money supply, the privileged, wealthy, and powerful few require large sums of capital, the ability to make decisions in secrecy, the ability to manipulate elected officials, and the ability to control education and the media. The proposals presented in this book are an antidote to these kinds of situations. The measures with the most significant impact, however, would likely be those that would minimize excessive and inappropriate concentrations of wealth. Such measures would include decommodifying land and other means of production and treating them as community assets, which can be made available to entrepreneurs working on behalf of society. Decommodifying money or currency and transforming money into a publicly transparent accounting system. In general, eliminating or reducing to a minimum wealth creation that does not result from creating products and services with real economic values. This would include eliminating speculation in stock, currencies, and land, and the charging of interest or fees for financial services that do not provide anything of real value to society. One of the goals of an associative economy is to make sufficient capital available to capable entrepreneurs who want to provide something of recognized value to a community. Thus, people's capacities and social responsibility will draw capital into circulation, not economic power or personal connections. Surplus capital beyond what is needed to support workers and management and for reinvestment purposes would be considered community assets or used to support cultural life rather than be treated as a private possession to be invested for personal gain or used to gain special privileges. This measure alone would remove much of the power base of any potential supra-rulers. There is some debate, even among critics of our current monetary system, as to who should issue currency and how that should be done. The author, Ellen Brown, recommends that government issue its own currency rather than a banking system headed by the Federal Reserve, and spend it into circulation through such projects as public works. But the unfortunate reality is that neither the banking sector nor the state can be trusted to create money if cultural, economic, and political arrangements remain the same as they are now. Author E.C. Riegel describes the situation like this. The money mechanism is a contrivance that is both political and private, but is strictly neither. It is a hybrid, and its name is finance. Compounded from both political and private interests, it comprises both private enterpriser and public service. It confounds students of money and causes them to take sides for either the banking end or the government end, when in fact, a plague should be put upon both their houses. Control over money should be denied to both government and banks. Footnote 109. Greco suggests the establishment of voluntary direct mutual credit clearing systems as a replacement for the current monetary system that is monopolized by a government-bank oligarchy. Transforming our existing economic structures can help prevent a relatively few wealthy people from gaining further control of our economy and financial system. However, new ways of using money for antisocial purposes will continue to surface if such outer restructuring, such as Greco recommends, is not accompanied by the moral elevation of those who work in those structures. When considering the relationship between human morality and money, Rudolf Steiner indicates that a certain level of social awareness and moral obligation eventually needs to arise in all individuals. First of all, we need to become aware of the fact that it is the labor of our fellow human beings, not money, which provides us with the necessities and luxuries that we may enjoy in life. And consequently, we need to develop the feeling of obligation to give back to society, while we are capable of doing so, the equivalent value of what we take from the economic circuit. The crux of the relationship is how we view and use money is a gauge of our interest and concern for others. Rudolf Steiner expresses this thought as follows. How many people are there today who have an abstract and confused conception of their personal lives? If they ask themselves, for example, what do I live on? They would say to themselves, why, my money. Money is not something on which we can live. My money has no value other than that of giving me the power to make use of the labor of others. Under the social conditions of the present time, we do not begin to have an interest in our fellow men until we hold the picture in our minds of a certain number of persons working for a certain number of hours in order that I may live within the social structure. No one loves people if he supposes that he is living on his money and does not in the least conceive how people work for him in order to produce even the minimum necessary for his life. But the thought that a certain number of persons labor in order that we may possess the minimum necessities of life is inseparable from another. This is the thought that we must recompense society, not with money, but with work in exchange for the work that has been done for us. We feel interest in our fellow man only when we are led to feel obligated to recompense in some form of labor the amount of labor that has been performed for us. The feeling of obligation to the society in which we live is the beginning of the interest that is required for a sound social order. Enjoyment should never really be accepted without repaying its equivalent to the whole of society. Footnote 110. While such thoughts point to the moral capacities that need to be developed in relationship to money, they still beg the question of who should issue money. The government? Private banks, or free associations of people, as Greco recommends. The direction that Steiner suggests is to remove the issue of currency from the state and place it within the economy. Money, after all, is meant to facilitate economic production and exchanges. The issuing of money would therefore be closely connected to the operations of economic associations in a threefold society, with their focus on efficient economic process. Only the implementation of the basic principles of a threefold organism can guarantee financial integrity and efficiency in this regard. In an associative economy with a threefold organism, self-serving interest groups, whether the state or private banks, would not control the issuing of money. Instead, economic associations would enable money to flow efficiently where and when it is needed, keeping money true to its nature as a representative of the economic values in circulation. Chapter 14. True Price. Every working person should receive sufficient remuneration for a commodity he produces to meet all his and his dependents' needs, until he has again produced another such commodity. Footnote 111. Rudolf Steiner, Toward Social Renewal, 1917. A true price is forthcoming when a person receives, as a countervalue for the product he has made, sufficient income to enable him to satisfy the world of his needs, including, of course, the needs of his dependents, until he will again have completed a like product. Footnote 112. Rudolf Steiner, World Economy, 1922. In his groundbreaking lectures in World Economy, Rudolf Steiner emphasizes the central importance of price formation in economics. When he first uses the actual term, true price, he admits that his formula for a true price is only an abstraction to begin with. Footnote 113. However, he maintains that his main objective here and in other lectures and writings on economics is to relate the whole of his spiritually based economic science to this initially abstract-seeming concept. For, as we will now demonstrate, all fundamental concepts of associative economics and social threefolding are inherent in what he develops and reveals as the principle of true price. Three spheres cooperating as equals. Steiner provides two formulations of true price, with commentary, that taken together comprise the foundation of a new economic science that honors the human spirit. His first discussions of the principle of a true price in 1917 assume certain prevailing conditions that are in harmony with the ideals of a threefold social organism. only within a social organism, managed on the basis of free cooperation between its three spheres, will it be possible to achieve a healthy relationship between price and commodity. Footnote 114. It is pointless to try to introduce the concept of true price on a large scale into an economic arena that dominates political and cultural life and, in turn, is dominated by private ownership of the means of production, self-interested behavior, and the desire to maximize personal profit. Under these conditions, the needs of a worker will be seen only as an expense to be reduced to a minimum. For example, present conditions allow the rights of a people to be overruled by economic interest groups with respect to the environment. Prices are artificially depressed or falsified in a given region whenever businesses exploit the environment and pass the cost of addressing pollution and restoring nature's balance on to other nations or to future generations. Even so, steps can be taken toward true pricing to the degree that basic human rights are upheld, and whenever a more associative way of working develops within an economic arena. Some examples are fair trade standards, community-supported farms, and ethical investing. Single enterprises can begin working with a triple bottom line that accounts for people, planet, and profit, rather than profit alone. In doing so, social and environmental factors can begin to be reflected in prices. A step in this direction was taken through the B Corp certification system for like-minded businesses. A certified B Corp must meet certain standards of social and environmental performance. Footnote 115. Decommodification of labor. Workers treated as co-producers. We have noted that one of the features of a new associative economy will be that workers will be treated as co-producers and partners with management, and will share the proceeds of the operations accordingly. In both formulations of true price, the worker is characterized as an independent entrepreneur or contractor, not a paid worker. Indeed, Rudolf Steiner maintains that we can never obtain true prices if workers are treated or act as mere wage earners. Those who to this day are still mere wage earners, earners of a living for themselves, how are they to be placed in the whole economic process? No longer as such earners, but as men who work because of social needs. Must this be done? Assuredly it must, for if this is not done, we shall never obtain true prices, but always false ones. Footnote 116. Chapter 14. True Price. Every working person should receive sufficient remuneration for a commodity he produces to meet all his and his dependents' needs until he has again produced another such commodity. Footnote 111. Rudolf Steiner, Toward Social Renewal, 1917. A true price is forthcoming when a person receives, as a countervalue for the product he has made, sufficient income to enable him to satisfy the world of his needs, including, of course, the needs of his dependents, until he will again have completed a like product. Footnote 112. Rudolf Steiner, World Economy, 1922. In his groundbreaking lectures in World Economy, Rudolf Steiner emphasizes the central importance of price formation in economics. When he first uses the actual term, true price, he admits that his formula for a true price is only an abstraction to begin with. Footnote 113. However, he maintains that his main objective here and in other lectures and writings on economics is to relate the whole of his spiritually based economic science to this initially abstract-seeming concept. For, as we will now demonstrate, all fundamental concepts of associative economics and social threefolding are inherent in what he develops and reveals as the principle of true price. Three spheres cooperating as equals. Steiner provides two formulations of true price, with commentary that, taken together, comprise the foundation of a new economic science that honors the human spirit. His first discussions of the principle of a true price in 1917 assume certain prevailing conditions that are in harmony with the ideals of a threefold social organism. Only within a social organism, managed on the basis of free cooperation between its three spheres, will it be possible to achieve a healthy relationship between price and commodity. Footnote 114. It is pointless to try to introduce the concept of true price on a large scale into an economic arena that dominates political and cultural life and, in turn, is dominated by private ownership of the means of production, self-interested behavior, and the desire to maximize personal profit. Under these conditions, the needs of a worker will be seen only as an expense to be reduced to a minimum. For example, present conditions allow the rights of a people to be overruled by economic interest groups with respect to the environment. Prices are artificially depressed or falsified in a given region whenever businesses exploit the environment and pass the cost of addressing pollution and restoring nature's balance on to other nations or to future generations. Even so, steps can be taken toward true pricing to the degree that basic human rights are upheld, and whenever a more associative way of working develops within an economic arena. Some examples are fair trade standards, community-supported farms, and ethical investing. Single enterprises can begin working with a triple bottom line that accounts for people, planet, and profit, rather than profit alone. In doing so, social and environmental factors can begin to be reflected in prices. A step in this direction was taken through the B Corp certification system for like-minded businesses. A certified B Corp must meet certain standards of social and environmental performance. Footnote 115. Decommodification of labor. Workers treated as co-producers. We have noted that one of the features of a new associative economy will be that workers will be treated as co-producers and partners with management, and will share the proceeds of the operations accordingly. In both formulations of true price, the worker is characterized as an independent entrepreneur or contractor, not a paid worker. Indeed, Rudolf Steiner maintains that we can never obtain true prices if workers are treated or act as mere wage earners, selling their labor like a commodity. Those who to this day are still mere wage earners, earners of a living for themselves, how are they to be placed in the whole economic process? No longer as such earners, but as men who work because of social needs. Must this be done? Assuredly, it must. For if this is not done, we shall never obtain true prices, but always false ones. Footnote 116. We can conclude from this position that if workers are seen only as a cost to production rather than co-producers, then the tendency will be to depress their income to the lowest possible amount. This tendency would continually falsify prices in the sense of true pricing. An essential feature of true pricing formulation is that it points to the future, not to what has been done or produced in the past. This feature is important for two reasons. One is financial. Looking to the future will give us a more realistic, true-to-the-facts picture of a person's need for financial support. If we base the anticipated support of workers on past statistics alone, they may receive less than what is needed to produce similar products in the future, owing to changing economic conditions. The other reason is spiritual. Typically, people are paid an income on a weekly, biweekly, or monthly basis, at the end of a pay period for work already performed. In contrast, true price formulation is based on what a person needs for support in the future. Thus, in keeping with the principles of true price and the fundamental social law, workers should be paid at the beginning of a pay period for work to be done. They would be receiving credit based on future productivity, just as enterprises typically do when they obtain credit for future production. Such an approach to remuneration thus enables or frees people to work on behalf of others rather than selling their labor. Decommodification of land and other means of production. Prices can be falsified in three ways. One is when the complete needs of all the workers involved in the productive process are not met. In this case, prices are falsified in a downward direction. Another way that prices are kept artificially low is through externalizing certain costs and passing them on to other people, perhaps in developing countries or in future generations. These can be seen as debts that are foisted on parties who have not freely agreed to such arrangements. The third way is when unjustified costs are incorporated into the price. For example, whenever land or other means of production are treated as a commodity and are bought and sold for profit, what we are actually paying for in any purchase or leasing of land rights, that is, the rights of access and use. Buying or renting land adds costs to any price calculation in the form of mortgages or rent payments that in turn offset mortgage payments. Rudolf Steiner makes an analogy between inflating currency and the inflationary effect assigning land itself an economic value. Economically speaking, it makes no essential difference whether, for example, I issue money which has no foundation in reality, but represents a mere increase in the amount of paper money, or whether I assign a capital value to land. In both cases, I am creating fictional values. By inflating currency, I increase prices of things numerically, but in the reality of economic process, I affect absolutely nothing except a redistribution which may do immense harm to individuals. In like manner, capitalizing of land does harm to those who are involved in the economic process. Footnote 117. The same insight can be applied to human-made means of production, which should also be viewed as community assets rather than private property, as already explained. Hence, buying and selling the means of production for profit also falsifies prices. Associations in meeting the needs of workers and consumers. Both of Rudolf Steiner's formulations of true price explicitly address the needs of the workers, but they also assume that the legitimate needs of the consumers are being met in an efficient manner. Inasmuch as the purely economic value of a commodity or service expresses itself in money, which represents its equivalent value, this value will depend on the efficiency with which economic management runs things within the economic organism. The value of a commodity in money terms will thus express the fact that this commodity has been produced via the economic process in quantities which correspond to need. Footnote 118. In the market economy, there is seldom an occasion where the needs of producers, including the workers, and consumers are taken into consideration in open dialogue. In fact, producers and consumers are pitted against each other in the market. One seeks the highest possible price, and the other seeks the lowest possible price, with little knowledge or concern for the other. We have seen that economic associations would provide the opportunity for all parties, producers, distributors, and consumers, to bring their needs to the table in full openness. Each party is then faced with the needs of the others. Thus, the agreed-upon price is established by the actual stakeholders through informed decision-making. Footnote 119. It is not imposed from outside by the state, nor simply left to the chances of the market and subject to the uncontrolled forces of supply and demand. Nor is it determined through price-fixing by colluding parties to maximize profits. Through associations, prices can be determined through transparent accounting, an informed analysis that reveal the complete costs and needs of each party involved. Falsification of prices through usury, speculation, and deficit spending. Prices can also be falsified through adding other unwarranted costs. When a person or institution gains wealth through speculation, or when governments authorize deficits with no intention of paying their debts, it has a general inflationary effect on prices and consequently adds to the overall expenses and needs of workers. Prices that are true, just, and ethical. This cursory review of how the main principles of social threefolding and associative economics are operative in Rudolf Steiner's concept of a true price shows true prices as a reflection of a healthy dynamic among the three spheres of social life. A price is true when, economically, products and services are produced in an efficient manner that meets real human needs as determined by economic associations. Democratically, land, labor, and capital are no longer treated as commodities. Workers receive a living income for themselves and their dependents, and the environment is protected from unjustified exploitation. Culturally, people are educated to develop their full creative capacities and to feel an ethical obligation to give back to the greater community, whenever possible, an equivalent value to what they have received from the labor of others. Chapter 15. Egoism and Social Life. In any effort to understand and transform social life, it is essential to address the issue of egoism. We will first summarize the treatment of egoism, as discussed in the preceding chapters, and then add further thoughts. Both the spiritual scientist Rudolf Steiner and the businessman and philanthropist Bill Gates agree that there are two fundamental forces in the human soul: egoism, self-interest, and love, caring for others. Rudolf Steiner calls the former forces antisocial and the latter social. In his spiritually based worldview, the development of human individuality in evolution is seen as necessary and appropriate preparation for our eventual consciousness reuniting with our divine nature. A natural byproduct of this development of individualism is the increase of antisocial forces arising in the human soul. These need to be counterbalanced by the cultivation of social forces consisting of love and a concern for our fellow human beings. This can be fostered through education of children, inner exercises for adults, and appropriately formed societal organizations and institutions. As we have seen, the fundamental social law reveals egoism as the root cause of poverty, want, and suffering in the world. And conversely, the foundation or backbone of a healthy and prosperous social life is the ability to take increasing interest in each other. For the development of social forces, an important inner quality to be fostered through education is the ability to think in pictures. Most education today encourages solely abstract thinking. Abstract thinking, especially when applied exclusively to social questions or issues, leaves the soul cold and indifferent to the thoughts, concerns, and plight of our fellow human beings. In contrast, imaginative thinking enables us to vividly picture or live into the situation of others. Another quality or capacity needed for the development of social forces is the ability to listen with the soul, not only to the thoughts of the other person, but also to the feelings that underlie the thoughts. Imaginative thinking and listening with the soul are important features of many new conversational techniques. The art and science of human conversation has become a significant component of social science research and practice over the last few decades. Several innovative approaches have been mentioned: appreciative learning, Goethean conversation, World Cafe, Theory U, nonviolent communication, and focused conversations. The antisocial forces that have arisen through the inevitable strengthening of the I or ego need to be counterbalanced by the appropriate structures and dynamics of each of the three main spheres of social life: cultural, rights, and economic. We have seen how in an independent cultural life, the egoistic desire to develop one's capacities to the fullest degree possible is acknowledged and supported. However, in the same measure, there needs to be a counterbalancing emphasis in education on developing social understanding, social sensitivity, and social skills. This dual emphasis results in what we have called ethical individualism. Self-directed human beings, whose individuality extends beyond personal ambition, to work out of care and concern for others in social life, including the economy. In an associative economy, we have a dynamic interplay between egoism and altruism. The goal is not to simply overcome egoism, but rather to address legitimate egoism in regard to the earthly needs of every person. All the legitimate requirements of consumers have their root in egoism. Rudolf Steiner expresses it this way. And it is important that this fact should be properly understood. If it is understood, no one will be impelled to ask with regard to the economic life, how can we overcome egoism? But rather, how is it possible for altruism to meet the just demands of egoism? Footnote 120. Two prerequisites for people to be able to work altruistically for others are, 1, that labor no longer be treated as a commodity, and 2, that they receive sufficient income to meet the needs of themselves and their dependents. Individuals who are continually preoccupied with the struggle for existence and who suffer the indignity of selling their labor for money can find little enthusiasm to work altruistically. True prices can never be obtained as long as workers are being exploited in such ways. The same is true for the environment. If out of egoism, we exploit the environment to further economic growth and maximize profits without replenishing resources, then environmental costs are passed on to future generations, and both current and future market prices are falsified. In a true democratic political life, an equilibrium is found between egoism and interest in others. Footnote 121. Individuality is expressed democratically by having an equal say in the elective processes. The democratic process then turns individual decisions into majority rulings. Thus, the individual yields to the decisions of the greater community. In addition, we as individuals expect equal protection under the law and trial by our peers if we are accused of transgressing the law. At the same time, we are expected to uphold equal protection and trial by jury for our fellow citizens out of concern for others. We can see in this brief summary how a social organism based on threefold principles can help maintain a healthy balance of the two fundamental forces in the human soul, self-interest and concern for others.